Welcome and bienvenidos to Mariachi DNA, a puro mariachi podcast. Grab your favorite tequila, sit back and enjoy.
Well, wait a second. I can't go on without my intro music here. So what's going on? Are we already screwing up?
No. That's later. Oh my God, I'm going to add it post.
You know what? I'm just going to go with it.
I'm going to post. Afterwards, it's radio magic.
The good thing about Mariachi USA at the Hollywood Bowl is that it's live, Tiger. Let me introduce who we are so people know what we're already arguing about. My name is Rodri. I'm the creator and executive producer, line producer of Mariachi USA Fest at the Hollywood Bowl.
And I'm Anthony Medrano, a.k.a. Tiger, which I've been given the name here by Rodri.
You christened you.
You christened me.
I became your madrina. How many years ago?
Tiger.
No, pues, ¿por qué contar?
Well, I was at the first one. Later I became part of the official Mariachi USA family as director for now 20 years.
You certainly did. Considering that you started as a folklorico dancer.
Oh, that was, yeah. And that was another lifetime and many pounds ago.
And then... And then joined, let's not talk about pounds right now. And then you joined Campanas de America, which we have a lot to talk about.
Yes.
Oh no, that's a whole one or two podcasts. That's a good one. Podcasts. Yes. We're really cool cats here. But the purpose for doing this is that we really wanted to celebrate 35 years of excellence with our fans. We're doing this because and for our fans who are responsible for making Mariachi USA the phenomena that it is. Not to put our artists second, but without our fans, without the energy that we receive from all of you year after year, artists could just not get on that stage. I don't care who it is, have said that that is one of the toughest stages to play, and it is yet one of the greatest stages to play because of the fans, of the synergy.
We're talking about... The stage is Mariachi. It's the Hollywood Bowl.
Stage, indeed.
With the history of, 100 years in existence.
Oh, my goodness. We've been there a little over one third of it.
Sometimes I feel like I've been there 100 years working with everybody. But the greats have played there. It's a destination for all the great artists to be on that stage if just for one song, you know, and... You've created a space for mariachis, so it's not just one song.
No, it's 45 minutes worth of a set that I don't know how these ladies and gentlemen do it to get up there for 45 minutes and entertain. And then they get off and go, wait a minute, we want more. We want to be up there more. And to get them on there, say, oh my God, can we make it through 5 minutes? You know, I was there, I saw Adele there, Donna Summer. I've seen all the greats there and even Streisand, and I've seen them forget lyrics. And not once have I seen any of our groups have any hiccups in their performance because they live off of and perform off of the passion of our fans. It's seamless and it's timeless because you're caught in this time warp that you think it's never going to end and it goes by so fast. It's like... And at first people criticized and said, oh, please, you're going to put mariachis up on there for 4 hours? Who's going to be able to stand that? And they're the very people that we couldn't get out of the Hollywood Bowl because they were so enthralled. They wanted more and more and more. And as you know, we used to do 2 days at one time.
Yeah.
And then after 9/11, because people stopped traveling for the obvious, we cut back to one day. And then we've never gotten back to that second day. We're working on it. But it's truly... There's nothing like it in the world because you have the synergy of the people that are there physically, and then you have the synergy of the people that are no longer there that have passed, because after 35 years, when you look at people who were 40 or 50 when they started coming to Mariachi USA, they've passed. And when you look at the artists that have stepped on that stage and performed, who have also passed, all of that energy comes at you when you're on the stage.
Yeah.
I mean... What do you feel when you perform on that stage?
Well, I always would like to describe it, and it's hard to describe to be on that stage. And there's close to 18,000 fans. I mean, not just people that don't have anything else to do. It's a destination. It's a spiritual destination, a cultural destination for a lot of people out there from the first year. And when you stand on the stage and look out, it's like, you know, it's not a field where you can, you're looking way past the field, 100, 200, 500 yards to see who's out there. It's a wall. So you see every face from right in front of you. And then you have to tilt your head towards the sky to see the rest of the people. It's an amazing, amazing place. And the energy's incredible. It is historic, iconic. And anybody who goes on there, especially us in the mariachi world, understand the space that we're in. And it's a beautiful feeling. And we got there because Rodri created that space. But tell me a little bit of how you got there, Rodri. I mean, because you didn't just like were born and then say, okay.
Oh, yes, I did.
Well, you were born, yeah, but you weren't born on the stage of the Hollywood Bowl presenting mariachi music.
No, although many people tend to think that perhaps I was, but no, there was life before mariachi was saved. The irony of it, Tiger, and it almost, you know, rings true to when you are destined to do something, it happens. And it's just, it's mission for me. But to think that I, as a Cuban, was baptized with a Mexican name, because my father would always call my mom Lupi, L-U-P-Y. And when I was born, my dad wanted to name me Lupi. And the Catholic Church says, well, you can't baptize her with that name. It has to be the name of a virgin or a saint. And the closest thing to it was Guadalupe. And so I was named Guadalupe. Fast forward, at age 7, I came to the United States on Operation Pedro Pan. And my parents felt that it was best for me. They wanted always for me to have freedom of speech and to have the freedom to be me. And so they dared to put me on a plane. I had just turned 7 years old, and I was sent to Miami, Florida, where they would shortly meet up with me, and 2 or 3 months turned into 7 years. I was placed in a foster home where I stayed for 7 years. And in that foster home in Albuquerque, New Mexico, I, of course, learned a different Spanish, but had to quickly learn English. It was a very difficult time for me, not just in the foster home, but also bullied in school, because according to the kids, and you know how kids are and how mean they can be, but my parents didn't want me. And so they sent me to the United States by myself. And then it was the same time as a missile crisis, and so much was going on with Cuba that I was sort of the persona non grata. And at 7 years old, you really don't understand much of the political aspects of how that is affecting your life. And so quickly I learned English, and you know, I began to win all the spelling bees. And then I was bullied because my English was too perfect. And so at an early age, I learned that you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. So quickly I learned that I had to do what was going to be best for me. And I became unstoppable, as even at that age. And yes, not without wounding. But I fell in love with music. I always loved music, even in Cuba. And so somehow all of that happening in that little girl's heart and soul, and then my parents were finally able to come out in 1969. They came to Los Angeles, and here I was in Los Angeles. I went to Immaculate Heart High School, what was called at the time the artsy-fartsy school, and loved every second of it. And then right at graduation, I realized that I was going to have to start working. My mom and dad... my dad was a shipbuilder, master carpenter. My mother was a seamstress. And there was no way that, you know, I wasn't smart enough. Oh, let's not say I'm not smart enough. I wasn't smart enough either. I just didn't have the grades to be able to get me into a college with scholarship. And so I began working for a little small newspaper called 20 de Mayo. And I used to write reviews of shows and criticize the hell out of the local promoters because their shows were really bad. I mean, really bad. They would bring 16 artists from Mexico, terrible sound, hardly any lighting. It was like they had a flashlight on. It was crazy. It was crazy times. And I started working for Latin International. Latin International, there was a hub. You know, it's where all of those that live in L.A. will know that the record industry in the United States was really born in that part of town, which was around Vermont, Pico, Olympic. Mozart Latin International, which was owned by the Garcias, Pepe Garcia. And so I was hired to do promotions. And for me, it was very exciting until I found out that I was the boss of three different departments. Actually, I was overseeing Miami, Puerto Rico, and Los Angeles, and I was the boss for three men, and they were all earning more money than me. And I said, okay, I'm out of here. But Pepe Garcia Jr. taught me so much. We used to do a live concert, and it was the Disco de Oro, and that's where we gave the golden record to artists that sold X amount of albums. And that is where I met Lucha Villa. And all of this, these lines, I mean, I could go on and on and on and on and be here forever and a day mentioning all the artists that I got to work with from Mexico that we would produce, that not we, because I was a mere, you know, schlepper and assistant learning from the bottom up everything about production. And so I'm very thankful to Pepe Garcia Sr. and Jr. for giving me the opportunity of learning. And we recorded unbeknownst. I mean, look where, I mean, I go from Havana to all of a sudden I'm in this place of that's recording Los Camperos. One of the first albums was done at Latin International. Wow. The album for Pedro Rey Los Galleros. And to me at the time, I loved listening to mariachi music.
Was this the first time that you were exposed to mariachi music, or that you were face to face with it?
No, I was exposed to it in Albuquerque.
Oh, okay. Yeah, of course.
And of course, in Albuquerque, they don't say Mexican-American. They're Spanish-American.
Yeah.
So, oh my God, qué confusión when I got to L.A. And then, no, somos mexicanos aquí. Somos mexicanos. Mexicanos. And then I had to figure out there's mexicanos and there's chicanos and there's pochos. And I was so confused because all I knew was I was a Cuban via Albuquerque. And, you know, I learned to eat all the New Mexico food. And but fast forward, I became immersed in the magic that is production. And I wanted to produce my own shows. And so while I was on the road promoting Latin International Records, I met a lot of record executives. And I got called one day and said, hey, we've got this artist we want you to produce, promote a concert, first concert in the United States. And I said, okay, and who is it? And they said, well, you're going to have to do a lot of promotion behind it. But we know, I mean, we've seen your skills at doing this. So he's going to be quite an artist. And I said, well, why don't you just tell me who it is already? And they said, well, his name is Julio Iglesias.
What?
And so I was ecstatic that, okay, we're going to produce Julio Iglesias now. I left the record company and the rest, as they say, is history. I started booking a lot of, not just booking, producing the shows at the Shrine Auditorium. And it was one person artist, which no one else was doing. Let's see, El Gordo Delgado and Tony DeMarco would send out their guys to pull down the posters that I would put up on posts. My dad and I would go out till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning and put up posters on the posts, because that's all the advertising I could afford, and putting flyers on the cars. And then, we'd come back another street and the posters would be gone, and I would be crying and crying and crying. And my dad would say, nope. Si vas a llorar, you can't be in this business. Vamos a ponerlos otra vez. So there we went again with those damn staplers that I got blisters with. I would do the lower poles and my dad would do the upper poles. Mm. And that's how I began my career, and selling tickets at meat markets and bakeries and jewelry stores. And I would go, at first I would go by myself, and they would just put the money in a paper bag. And here I was picking up $10,000, $15,000, $20,000. From ticket sales, because the shows that I was doing, I mean, it was Roberto Carlos, Camilo Sesto, all the top artists that had never come to Los Angeles before. And it was surreal for me, but at the same time, I was so grounded in knowing that it was a vision that I had, that I loved the music, and I wanted to present quality performances for our audience. Because at the very helm of everything I've done, Anthony Tiger, my Tiger, is, I take ownership of him, by the way. Laura is his wife and she lets me, is that music really motivates the spirit. It's not just healing, but it's what it does to that moment when you're listening to that song live, when you see that person performing. And that was just, that's all I ate, breathed, talked about then. And I still do now. Fast forward, I mean, we're talking almost 50 years to do what I still do. And think about it. Cuban named Guadalupe, comes to Los Angeles to eventually produce mariachi. I mean, what right. are the chances yeah. on a world-class stage? You know, yeah. it's one of the top three stages in the world where mariachi deserves to be.
Well, your journey was felt like it was scripted to end, or not to end, but to wind up at the world-renowned Hollywood Bowl with the greatest show that mariachi has ever seen. Do you think that when you were doing those other things back there, stapling those stuff, the posters to the poles and everything, were you already having the vision of your future of what was down the road? Or were you just in real time, just wanted to soak up as much as you can and fight every battle and see where you ended up? Or were you already looking to where we are now?
Well, as a young girl, I really didn't have dreams. Because I was in an abusive foster home, and while it was very damaging to my spirit, it also created strength and has enabled me to be the woman that I am today. So with everything I did with intention, and it was very deliberate. I knew what I was doing, and I knew what I was going to have to do being the only woman for the longest time in the world doing what I was doing. I knew that I had to be the very best. And I never matched myself up against anyone. I'm always only as good as my last show. I'm always only as good as the person I wake up looking at in the mirror, only when I brush my teeth. So it's not that like I had this laid out perfect plan of what I was going to do. And I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that.
You weren't 13 years old writing out Mariachi USA and drawing.
No.
But you were, and I'll share this, and we're doing this podcast for the reason of talking about Mariachi USA, you know, and your journey and what it means to a lot of people. And you mentioned that the stories with Lucha Villa and in future broadcasts, let everybody know, podcast, you know, we plan to talk about it. We plan to go, you know, there's so much to talk about. So this is not just a one and done little podcast here. I mean.
Well, you wanted the chisme on me because.
I know.
And thank you, because a lot of people think that. You know, Rodri started in 1990 with Mariachi USA, so they really don't know my production experience from record company and the very humble effect that I had on securing a category for Latin music within the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences. Right. And how much hustling I had to do in order to make that happen with others, of course. But that entire process, they now know about the Latin Grammys, but back then we didn't. We had one right. category and they threw everybody in there.
Yeah.
And I was able to receive a Grammy on behalf of Mongo Santa Maria.
Wow.
At one of the ceremonies. It was the very first Latin Grammy that they gave. That was back in 1975, 76, mm-hmm. around there somewhere. Mm-hmm. Still have that photo. And it's been, you know, little things. It's sort of like little stepping stones that you build, you know, and you pick them up and they don't have to be perfect. They're rough, and the rougher they are, the more beautiful that walkway looks, you know.
Yeah.
And a lot of times you have to walk that road barefoot, and sometimes, you know, you have to carry yourself 10 times over to make sure that at least that somebody can go beside you or in front of you or behind you or whatever it is, but to be creating that road that keeps motion going forward. And with that, you start looking at what is it that I, you know, there's so many different angles. There's a sociopolitical angle. There's the angle of Latinas, just women in general. And then the music itself. What has had to happen for mariachi to be able to get to a stage like the Hollywood Bowl?
Thanks for joining us at Mariachi USA. If you sing El Rey, you have Mariachi DNA.
Mariachi USA, the mariachi capital of America.